make a Kahoot.
Okay, no, good morning, Amudot. I'm recording this because since some people are out sick, what we're doing today, even though next semester hasn't started yet, is really an introduction to next semester when we'll be studying the thought of Rabbi Soloveitchik, principally the Lonely Man of Faith. Although today we're going to be looking at something else. But since it's an introduction to that, I'm recording it so that all of the Amudot can sit around their record player and listen to it.
Yeah, how do you
listen? It'll be an activity. Oh. I'll send a link. Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. In Hebrew, we use that acronym, Gimel Resh Yud Dal, Gaon Rabbeinu Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. Lived from 1903 to 1993. Now, I assume, given your pedigrees, this is a name that's familiar to you. You've probably heard people talk about the Rav countless times in your education. There he is, hanging on the wall, late in life. Is a word of biography useful here? Or?
I think so.
In other words, it's all you were all born when, in like 2003?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right, so you were like, you know, he died 20 years before you were born. And when you're only 20, 20 years seems like a lifetime. But some of us were alive when the Rav was alive. The Rav was born in 1903. He was the son of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. He was the grandson of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, also called Reb Chaim Brisker, after the town Brest-Litovsk, which the Jews called Brisk, which today is in Belarus, but then was part of what we call Lita, you know, Greater Lithuania. He was born in a town called Pruzhan, where his maternal family was from. His mother was from the family of the Feinsteins. In this way, he was somehow a cousin to Rav Moshe Feinstein, another name from 20th century rabbinic legend that you should be familiar with. But as a young boy, he moves with his family to a little town called Chaslovich, which, unless you pass through it, you would have never heard of. Chaslovich was a Chabad town, meaning most of the Jews there were Chabad Hasidim. But the custom in the town was to hire a misnagdik, a Litvish Rav, to be the rabbi of the town. And young Yosha Ber, as he was known, father of Moshe, became the Rav of this town, Chaslovich. As a young boy, Yosha Ber is just Yiddish for Yosef Dov. Mm. Right? Dov is a bear, and Yiddish is called a bear. Yosha Ber is sent off to Cheder, you know, the one-room traditional Jewish schoolhouse for boys, where they learn principally Gemara. And at a certain point, his grandfather, Reb Chaim, who had, you've heard of Reb Chaim, mm-hmm. Reb Chaim Brisker, Brisker Torah.
So what was the name of his father, sorry?
Moshe.
Right?
His grandfather, Reb Chaim, who was kind of the innovator of this new method of Talmudic analysis, which we call Brisker Lumdus, kind of way of like approaching the Gemara, a set of questions to ask, to impose on the text. Reb Chaim examines his young Einikol, his young grandson, and finds him to be wanting, finds him not to be up to snuff. So he instructs the Rav's mother, his daughter-in-law, you tell my son, take him out of that cheder, it's just going to ruin him, and he should learn one-on-one with his father. This, of course, parallels the story I mentioned the first time we met when we discussed Agnon, who was also taken out of cheder. In Agnon's case, it was the opposite. Agnon was considered to be too smart. Right? He was cheder was just going to slow him down. And the Reb Chaim thought, because after all, cheder was the democratization of education. Right? In other words, one cookie cutter size fits all.
And why was he taken out of cheder?
Because Reb Chaim thought he wasn't progressing sufficiently. And from that point on, he learns one-on-one with his father, and really never has any other formal Jewish education. He's a complete autodidact, aside from these couple of years in Cheder. The Cheder Rebbe was a Malamed, was a Chabadnik, who would hold the Gemara like this, with the Tanya hidden inside, in case somebody came to look to see he wouldn't be caught teaching them Tanya, this foundational work of Chabad Chassidut. He was teaching them Gemara. But the Rav very often throughout his life spoke very warmly and very fondly of Chassidut, even though he was from this arch, his DNA, his pedigree couldn't have been more misnagdic, but yet he spoke very warmly of the power and influence of Chassidut on him as a young boy, and of the Tanya in particular. Later in life, he became friends with the Lubavitcher Rebbe in New York. They knew each other from their time studying in universities in Europe. And there was some event, I forget what it was, the Rebbe's 70th birthday. I don't recall. And there was a Fabreng in Crown Heights at 770. And the Rav went to attend this event. It was considered this great meeting. The descendant of the most pedigreed Hasidic family and the descendant of the most pedigreed Misnagdic family reunite to do tshuva for the conflict between the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon and all those that came after them. There's actually a video of it on YouTube. You can find it if you look. In 1924, the Rav goes off to study in what we would call college. It was something called the Polish Free University. And he goes off to study. After studying in Warsaw, he then moves to the University of Berlin, where he studies Neo-Kantian philosophy, doing a doctorate on the works of Hermann Cohen. I'm going to be mentioning a lot of names of figures and philosophers. I had suggested to you when we started studying last semester, take a note card, take a page in your notebook. What is that? Oh, that's an electronic notebook you have in your hand. Yeah. And, open up a page there and just make a list of all these names and titles of books and other things I'm throwing out at you. If you don't know them, you have ready access to the entire collected wisdom of Western civilization at your fingertips. And you could look these things up. Usually a trip to Wikipedia is all you need. There's also a wonderful resource online for anybody studying philosophy, and that's the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which is free online. So on any philosophical concept, like existentialism, you could go and you could read the entry of the Stanford, Stanford University, Encyclopedia of Philosophy. And it's a great way to fill in all of these gaps in your education.
So while he was studying with his father, where did he learn secular studies?
He didn't. First of all, he was apparently very bright. He read things on his own, and he caught up. His mother was something of an influence in making him aware of literature and Yiddish writers and poetry and things like that. But he was just a complete autodidact. In Berlin, he meets a woman who becomes his wife, Tanya Levitt, who becomes his extremely close bond between the two of them. They're partners in most of their endeavors. She herself was a very bright, educated woman. They have a child, but in 1932, they leave Europe and head off to the United States. I'm going to abbreviate the biography now.
What was that child's name?
That child was Atara, who married Rabbi Professor Isidore Twersky, who was the Talna Rebbe in Boston and was a professor of Jewish studies at Harvard. The Rebbe had three children. The eldest is Dr. Atara Twersky, who was married to Professor Isidore Twersky, Rabbi Isidore Twersky. Then there was Tova Lichtenstein, who was married to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and lives here in Alon Shvut. And Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, who is professor of Jewish history at Yeshiva University and the author of Rupture and Reconstruction, which seems to be an article that's come across your radar at some point in your Amudim career. I'm going to abbreviate his biography, but the long and short of it is that the Rav arrives in America really without a job in hand. He's a young man, and even though he has all this yichus and all this brilliance, it's the middle of the Depression, and jobs are hard to come by. his father, who had preceded him to America and was the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan in New York, the institution which, you know, becomes Yeshiva College and then and Yeshiva University, was not able to secure a position for his own son because of the financial situation. And the Rav goes to Boston and becomes the chief rabbi. This is an un-American model. In America, we don't have chief rabbis. That's an English thing. He becomes the rabbi of the city of Boston, of the Orthodox congregations of Boston, that is. And while there, he founds the Maimonides. We don't have any Maimonides students this year. He founds the Maimonides School, which is the first Jewish day school in New England, and one of the first Jewish day schools in the United States. He does this together with his wife, and together they lead the school throughout all of their years. In 1941, when his father dies, he is selected to succeed him as the Rosh Yeshiva of YU, of Yeshiva University, Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. But he doesn't leave Boston. For the rest of his life, he commutes between Boston and New York, spending 3 or 4 days a week in New York, and then traveling back to Boston, you know, on the long weekends, continuing to manage each of the things. Along the way,
We heard from the person who, like, when...
Oh, you, Rabbi Adler was here. Yeah, right. So the Rav always had these kinds of shamashim, people that helped him and took care of him and drove him back and forth to the airport. And Rav Aaron Adler wrote this book with his little reminiscences of those experiences. He becomes the undisputed figure, the undisputed head, ideological head, halachic head, religious head, spiritual head, of the movement that comes to be known as modern orthodoxy, even though he himself never uses that term, and he himself is occasionally critical of this community that looks to him as its head. His principal role, mode of influence, was teaching. He taught constantly. He taught the students in the yeshiva, he taught the smicha students, the rabbinical students, he taught adult education in synagogues and communities back home in Boston. He wrote little, although many of his public addresses, which would gather thousands, people would gather for on the yard site of his father. He would give a major shiur on the yard site later of his wife. During a Aseret Yemei Tshuva, between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, he would give a tshuva lecture, and thousands would come to overflow audiences. In those days, there was no Zoom, you understand. People would fill the large auditorium in Yeshiva University, and the overflow crowd would be put in another room, and they would pipe in the sound, right? You would listen to the audio. There was no video, of course. And those lectures would sometimes go on for 3-4 hours. In Yiddish, his native language, in which he was extraordinarily fluent, but even later in English, which he spoke with something of a European accent, but with this extraordinarily rich vocabulary. There are recordings of him in both languages available online, and I recommend listening to them just to hear the pathos, the rhythm of his power as an orator, which was unequaled. Many of those lectures, those public lectures, and also many of the Shiurim in Gemara, were written up by others and published. But he himself wrote very little in his lifetime. And we, over the next semester, are going to talk about two works. First, Halachic Man, which was published first in 1944 in Hebrew as... Yes, in 1944. It was published in Hebrew as Ish HaHalacha. And then only later in the 80s translated to English, but it was translated not by the Rav, but with the Rav. The translator, Professor Lawrence Kaplan, worked with the Rav in preparing the translation. And The Lonely Man of Faith. The Lonely Man of Faith was published in 1965 in a little journal called Tradition, which, by some odd twist of my own biography, I happen to be the editor of at the moment, but not in 1965, you understand, because I wasn't alive. The Lonely Man of Faith is the Rav's most important essay written by him in English. Now, do you understand? There are many things you read from the Rav, he didn't write them. He spoke them and other people wrote them up. Or he left behind notes from a lecture and those were turned into an essay or an article. Right? Or they're transcripts of recordings of things. Or their translations from things he wrote in Hebrew. This is an essay the Rav wrote in his own hand in English, and reading it is, for those of us that will only read him in English, is the best direct contact with the person himself. It is, no doubt, his most autobiographical essay. This character, the lonely man of faith, is him. He's describing his own inner life. We're going to get into that a little bit later when we start the study of the book. I think they may have mentioned to you, you need to get a copy of the book for when we start studying it. It's available in many different editions at this point, including the original edition that appeared in Tradition, which you can get online on the website of traditiononline.org. You can get the original essay in its original formatting. Unfortunately, because there's so many editions, it becomes a bit of a, like, unless we were to force everyone to get the same edition, it becomes a little bit of a headache in studying it together, because the page numbers all differ. The other day when we were reading Agnon's Pat Shlema, I mentioned this idea, this point of intersection between Agnon and the Rav, even though they didn't seem to know each other. There's no indication that the Rav ever read Agnon, even though he read much of other Hebrew and Yiddish literature. Agnon was a bit later. He wouldn't have encountered him in his youth, that's for sure. And Agnon doesn't seem to have any indication that he was paying attention to Rabbi Soloveitchik. None of the Rav's writings are in Agnon's library. It would have been interesting to think of the meeting of these minds. Even though Agnon only once visited America, in June 1967, he received an honorary doctorate at YU's graduation. But the Rav was not in attendance, it seems. And then Agnon cut his trip short because the Six-Day War broke out, and he returned immediately to Israel. But what we saw in that story, and then what I mentioned by way of passing in the reference to C.S. Lewis, this kind of paradox of man, the enigma of man, that we are both mammals like any other, right? If we don't have our coffee in the morning, we can't get going, right? It's a sign of our physicality, of being, well, to one degree, beasts of the field like all the rest. But also, v'yechsarehu me'at me'elokim. God created us, but just a hair's breadth below him. We're at the pinnacle of creation. We're not just animals. We're angels, or we aspire to be. We are commanded with mitzvot. We are sanctified. We have a mission. We have a task. You know, the animals don't have a mission. The animals don't even have virtues and vices. When you're a little kid and you're watching the National Geographic and you're watching the lion hunting the poor little antelope and you see the baby antelope getting killed, so we're rooting for the antelope and we're booing the lion. But it's completely anthropomorphizing to put our values. If we see Reuven chasing Shimon down the street, mugs him and murders him, we know who the good guy, we know who the bad guy. There's a value system at play. But for the lion, the antelope, that's not true. The lion's not bad. The lion's not evil because he eats the antelope. The lion is doing what his instincts, his genetics, his DNA tell him. And if he doesn't follow those instincts, you know what happens?
He dies.
He dies. Well, there are no vegetarian lions. There are no vegan lions. Last night we had sushi, and my daughter, my 10-year-old, says, "I want you to know, from now on, I'm a vegan." I said, "Adi, you're eating fish right now." So she says, "Oh, well, what's that thing where you're allowed to eat fish?" I said, "You mean a vegetarian?" She said, "Yes, I've been a vegetarian for a week now." I said, "Last night you had a hamburger." That doesn't count. the lion is not.
And wait, have you guys seen Madagascar? You know how at the end he tries sushi and then he's like, "Yeah, it's my new diet." Sushi is the new diet.
This what we call this dialectic is at the center of the Rav's thought, both in terms of understanding the human condition, as well as in general. Now, what are dialectics? What does the word dialectic mean? It's a Greek word. It's related to our word dialogue. What? Well, it has to do with speech in the sense that a dialogue is a conversation between two sides. So dialectics in philosophy is a kind of form of reasoning that examines two opposing propositions. Now, in classical Greek dialectics, in Aristotle's conception of what dialectics are, here, by the way, asterisk, perfect example. Dialectics is a concept in philosophy. It's had many different iterations. It's meant different things at different times in the history of philosophy and also in the history of logic. You understand logic is a kind of subfield of philosophy. If you're unsure what this means, now is the time. Because through the rest of your life, you're going to be at Kiddush and somebody's going to be talking about the dialectic. Right? And they're going to be using it wrong. Right? And here's your chance to find out what it really means and be smart.
So how do you use it in a sentence?
That's what we're going to be doing for the rest of the morning, so you'll see. But dialectics is the sense of analyzing an issue or a problem through two opposing viewpoints to get at the truth. Aristotle had an idea of the excluded middle. That's the concept, excluded middle. If you Google that term, Aristotle, excluded middle, you'll find this. That there are two propositions on the table. There's A and there's B. And there's no room in the middle. Either this is a cup or it is not a cup. Proposition A, it is a cup. Proposition B, it is not a cup. Discuss. Right? It can't be both. Both of those statements can't be true. Right? There are many famous logical puzzles that are built on this idea. In order to you don't know Star Trek, so it'll just be another example of me throwing out a cultural reference that you don't understand. But do you know who Mr. Spock is?
Yeah.
Mr. Spock. Oh yeah. Oh, you know Star Trek. Yeah, I admired you for that. Spock is a Vulcan, and their culture is ruled entirely by logic. But there's a computer that's taken over the Enterprise. Now, of course, in the 1960s, the computers that they imagine are a fraction of the sophistication of the devices we now carry around in our pockets. They're imagining the 23rd century, right? But the computer has taken over the ship, so they have to have the computer self-destruct. So how does he do it? He tells the computer, accept the following two propositions as true. A, everything I say is true. B, statement A is a lie. Compute. And the computer starts, the lights are flashing, and the computer's going, computing, and then suddenly smoke starts pouring in. It's very cheesy special effects, right? Right? You cannot resolve those two statements. So dialectics, at least in the Aristotelian sense, looks at these two propositions that contradict each other, and one of them must be false.
What was the middle thing?
The excluded middle. It's either this or that. There's no middle ground. But you've been studying Gemara for a while. Would you say that Chazal's view of dialectics jives with that?
No.
No.
They argue with each other
the whole
time.
But there's always
Shnei ktuvim hamakhishim ze et ze ad. You have two contradictory premises or two contradictory verses. There can be a resolution in the kind of algorithm of the Talmudic debate. The Mishnah says something. The Braita says something else. V'raminhu. There's an attack. We're going to raise up a contradictory source. I always imagine it as heretical as it may seem. I always imagine it as a game of poker. I don't play poker. I don't even know how the game works, but I know enough to know that we each hold a hand of cards. And depending upon which cards are in my hand, they're going to beat, you know, the set of cards, or not, that are in your hand. And at the end, we put our cards on the table, we show our sources, and we figure out, does a full house beat a straight flush, or the two of a coin beat this or that or the other thing? There are different hands of cards. So there's a Mishnah, and the Braita seems to contradict it. Right? So Chazal, for some reason, was so disturbed by that idea that there could be conflict. What's even worse is Kasha the Rebbe Meir, Ad the Rebbe Meir. Rebbe Meir says one thing in one place, and he says another thing in another place. It's one thing that maybe Rebbe Akiva and Rebbe Meir disagree. Okay, people disagree. We don't even like that. We want to find a way to square that circle. But how could Rebbe Meir contradict himself? He was a very smart man. It is hot, isn't it?
Yeah,
so if you want, we could turn it down and drop it, unless people are freezing. So the idea of the resolution of contradictions. Hocha b'maya skinan.
What are we dealing with?
Yeah. In other words, apples and oranges. It's not a contradiction. Source A and source B seem to be in conflict. It's not a contradiction because we're talking about two different cases. Right? Sometimes, you know, and there's a kind of algorithm of the kind of preferable ways of resolving conflict. Right? Sometimes we'll say it's not really a conflict because source B, that seems to be in conflict with source A, has been misread or misreported, right? Because in the oral tradition, that sometimes happens. At the end of the day, sometimes you just say, "And achinami, there's a machlokas." And when there's a machlokas in a matter of halacha, of normative practice, so then you have to arrive at the halacha lemaaseh. Right? Well, what do we do? Is this act allowed on Shabbat or is it not allowed on Shabbat? Is this piece of meat kosher or is this piece of meat not kosher? Because people need to know what they do on Saturdays and what they can eat from the refrigerator. But that doesn't mean that the rejected opinion is false. The rejected opinion, the non-normative opinion, remains true in a kind of certain pristine sense. And sometimes rejected opinions in one matter are revived to be used as a basis in other matters. So for Rabbi Soloveitchik, dialectics are central to his thought. And we see it all over the place. I mean, you may have been around the block enough times to have heard these names, Adam 1 and Adam 2. Yes?
Yep.
These are going to be the two main characters we're going to be spending time with over the next semester. There are two different depictions of the human personality. I should mention now, all of these use of gendered language, lonely man of faith, halachic man, right? These are just functions of essays that were written in the mid-20th century. There is nothing in any of the Rav's works where he presents these types of typological characters to think that it refers to one gender over the other. Women are described as accurately by this typology as by this typology as by any other. It's the halachic personality, the lonely person of faith, right? The lonely human of faith. But we'll continue using the gendered language in which the essays were written. The Rav would take these typological characters, these kinds of pure figures, which may or may not exist in the actual world, right? Because in the actual world, we're all kind of composite figures. And as a matter of fact, in The Lonely Man of Faith, where he introduces us to these two different types of characters, Adam 1 and Adam 2, right? Thing 1 and Thing 2. Those of you that remember Cat and Hat, Adam 1 and Adam 2, they're two different aspects of the human personality. In fact, there really is no one who is only Adam 1 or only Adam 2. You know, as if you could take a human being and put them into a centrifuge and spin it out into two different parts. Right? We all have both of these. It's a thought experiment to understand something about how the religious personality, the human personality, is constructed. Right? But in reality, we possess both of these, and finding the way to keep them in balance, despite the tension between them in our own personalities, is the purpose of this book. But we see this in all types of other ways in his thought. He talks about the natural religious experience, and the revelatory experience. Right? We can sense God by going out into the world. Right? You look at a sunset, you look at the Grand Canyon. And you also experience God through revelation. I mean, once revelation was in the form of Nevuah. We stood at Sinai and we heard his, right? But now we have revelation transmitted to us through all of these books. That's his conception of part of what Talmud Torah is. Talmud Torah, Torah study, particularly studying Gemara, but not only, is a kind of encounter with the divine. Right? It's a replacement of sorts for revelation of prophecy. The dialectic between the individual and the community. Rabbi Soloveitchik places tremendous importance on the integrity of the individual. Many religious philosophers, many religious Jewish philosophers, spend a lot more time talking about the collective, about the Jewish people. Rabbi Soloveitchik spends much more time talking about individuals. Think of all of his great characters. The lonely man of faith, the halachic man, the cognitive man, the religious person man, the ethical man, right? The Rosh Chodesh man, Yom Kippur man, Rosh Hashanah man. You know, these were all different ways. He would sometimes, one of his greatest oratory forms was the Hesped, right? Somebody would die and he would be asked to give a eulogy. Very often those great eulogies, those eulogies that are worth reading, you know, generations later, were not delivered at the funerals. But you know, so if somebody dies that morning, that afternoon's the funeral. You don't have time to prepare a great piece of oratory. You know, if you go to a funeral, and people speak at the funeral, very often the people that are speaking at the funeral, the ones that are most emotionally traumatized by it. You always have to grade a eulogy delivered at a funeral on a curve. Right? Because, you know, in the context, it's a very hard thing to do. So many of the Rav's greatest eulogies were delivered, you know, maybe at the Shloshim or at the first Yahrzeit or later on when he had the kind of time to prepare a proper piece of oratory and rhetoric. And very often what he would do is he would like point to something, create a character, like almost as if he had this stock of characters, you know, on the shelf. And he would talk about, you know, there are two different types of ways of looking at something. There are people that are Rosh Hashanah people, and there are people that are Yom Kippur people. And they would say that each of them represents something of the essence of those days. And our dearly departed, he was a Yom Kippur man. He was a Rosh Chodesh man. He was a whatever it was. You know, he embodied that typology of the individual. The Rav, as a matter of fact, could hardly be considered a theologian. What's a theologian? What's theology? Not religion specific. What's theo? What's theos in Greek? God, right? They're philosophers of religion in the sense that their main subject of examination is God, who after all is a pretty major figure in religion. What, you're cold?
Yeah, I'm really cold over there. There's nothing.
So come sit here.
Yeah, come sit here. No, it's fine. I just turned it on. No, oh. I know.
Now you're making the overall room hotter.
Yeah. It's not, and I don't know that everyone over there is cold.
So the Rav is more like a religious anthropologist. What's anthropology? The study of humanity. He's concerned with the individual. The Rav and Rav Kook are very often compared. They were the two most significant rabbinic thinkers in the 20th century. They met on one occasion. The Rav only once made a visit to Eretz Yisrael in 1935. The Rav, a young man at the time, was a candidate to become chief rabbi of the city of Tel Aviv. He lost the election. But on that occasion, on that visit, he met with Rav Kook, who was then quite near death. I wrote an essay in Tradition about the encounter between Rav Kook and the Rav, which, if this topic interests you, you can find on the Tradition website. Rav Kook, and much of religious Zionist thought, places a focus on the collective, for natural reasons, on the nation. Right? These were people here in the land of Israel or outside of the land of Israel, focusing their attention on it, who wanted to understand something about these processes that the nation was undergoing. The Rav was always much more, even though the Rav himself was a self-identified religious Zionist, he authors one of the most important essays in the canon of religious Zionist thought, an essay called Kol Dodido Fake, which has been translated in two different ways. Hark, the voice of my beloved knocketh. It's a pasuk from Shir HaShirim, about the tfikot, the knocks, recognizing God's hand in history and understanding, particularly in light of the Shoah, what the significance of the modern state of Israel is. In tradition, last year we published an essay, a lost manuscript of the Rav. It was a speech that he gave in the weeks, I think in the days following the establishment of the state, about the significance of Jewish sovereignty. The Rav himself was an ardent religious Zionist, but his thought was much more focused on this question of the individual. Other types of dichotomies, majesty versus humility, that's a topic we're going to come back to in the Lonely Man of Faith. Even you might say Torah Umada, which was not a term that the Rav ever used, but that idea of the synthesis or the coincidence or the living side by side in harmony or intention of Torah properly defined and worldly wisdom, worldly culture, and the relationship between the two of them can be understood as a dialectical relationship. Even the whole idea of modern orthodoxy can be understood as a dialectic. What does it mean to be someone deeply embedded and rooted and committed to a tradition of values and commitments and obligations and rituals and lifestyle and thought? Orthodoxy, after all, means proper thought, not proper behavior. And to be modern, to be a member of the citizen of the modern world, to be an heir to Western civilization. And the resolution of the inherent conflicts between those two can be seen as a dialectic. Socrates thought that the two opposing ideas, one has to win. One has to overrule the other. They can't both be true. Later, dialectics takes on a kind of different approach. Most famously championed by the German philosopher George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, a late 18th, early 19th century German philosopher. Hegel, if you are unfamiliar with him, again, you can find lots of information online. Hegel puts forth this idea of two ideas in opposition, the thesis and the antithesis, the yin and the yang, right? The matter and the antimatter. And how do we manage that tension? What comes after thesis and antithesis? Synthesis. And Hegel proposes this idea that not all ideas that are in contradiction are irresolvable. As a matter of fact, in our tradition, we see that this is true all the time. According to the Rambam, according to the Rambam, there are two main avenues to relate to God. There's Ahava and Yira. There's love and there's awe, but the kind of awe which is almost petrifying. How can those to be resolved? They can be resolved. We live in a complicated relationship with the divine. In Kabbalah, you have these opposing poles of Gvura and Chesed. Right? Might, strength, and soft, kindness, charity, mercy, as God's kind of characteristics. Or in different terms, we talk about din and chesed, din and rachamim, rather,
God is a judge. Judges, right? In other words, we know, isn't it? It's like, almost like a machine. You know, like these, all of these, candidates, nominees for Supreme Court positions have to go up to their nomination hearings, and they don't want anybody to think that they have any opinions about anything, because the people that disagree with their opinions, if you're pro-abortion, if you're anti-abortion, if you're pro-gun rights, if you're anti-gun rights, so you don't want to be antagonized by the opposing side. So you say, I have no positions. It's just the law in the abstract. And I'm just the umpire. You know, that's what John Roberts famously, the Chief Justice famously said
of
the United States Supreme Court. Said in his hearings. He said, I'm the umpire calling balls and strikes. Right? The ball either went over the plate or it didn't go over the plate. It's an objective fact. In other words, as if like judges are nothing more than computers. You put the data in and you get the result. And then there's the idea of rachamim, that we are judged in some kind of charitable way. I mean, even the idea, so common in Brisk. What's the most? If you only know one thing from Brisker Torah, what is it? Which is what?
Like
delving deeply. No, but in other words, there's like a whole, like a little toolkit of Brisker methodologically. Tzvei dinim. Two aspects. Two elements. We say, look, there's a problem here. Right? The Rambam in one place says that you need kavana in tefillah for the entire Amidah. And if you are lacking kavana, like if as you're saying the Amidah, like there's one word that you like tuned out for, it could happen. Not to me, but maybe to some people. It could happen that you could lose kavana in the middle of davening Amidah. So if you're lacking kavana, even for one word, so the whole tefillah doesn't count. It's all pasuk. And in another halacha, the Rambam says, you need kavana for the first year. You should strive for kavana for the whole thing, but you require kavana for the first bracha. So isn't that a contradiction? In the Rambam, these two halachot appear in Hilchot Tefillah. So that's one way of resolving it, to say, l'chadchili, you should have for the whole thing, and b'di'eved, you know, if you only have for the first one, you're okay. But these halachot are not presented that way. Right? Shem Chaim says, no, tzvei dinim. Tzvei is Yiddish for two. Shnei dinim. There are two different halachot at play here. Right? One is the halacha for awareness of what the words mean. That's one kind of kavana. There are two aspects to kavana. For one type of kavana, you need for the entire Amidah. For the other type of kavana, it's sufficient if you only have the first bracha. Which kind do you need for the whole Amidah? No. Because that's easy.
Exactly.
The awareness that while you are praying, you are standing before God. That this act, Hashem Svatai, that this act is Amidah Lefnei Hashem. That in the, I don't know, how long do you say the Amidah for? 20 minutes, 30 minutes?
2 minutes,
right? At the time that you are standing in Amidah, and remember in halachic language, prayer, tefillah, means the Amidah. In technical halachic language, tefillah means the Amidah. It's not Shema, it's not Ashrei Yoshev Vesecho, it's not Adon Olam, it's not Pesuket Zimra. Those are other important things. So tefillah means the Amidah. The Shmon Esu. So the definition, what is the definition of that act? Standing before God. So if you're unaware, if you lose that kind of awareness that what you're doing is standing before God, so then it's not, definitionally, it's not a prayer. If I take the lulav, and the etrog, and the hadassim, and the aravot, and I have all of the kavanot, and I shake them in all the right directions, but instead of taking an etrog, I took a lemon. You can understand how the two might be mixed up. Have I fulfilled or not fulfilled the mitzvah? Why? Because it wasn't. Definitionally, all the kavanah in the world, doesn't work if definitionally the object in my hand is
a lemon.
So definitionally, if you are standing in prayer and you lose kavanah, it's a lemon. Knowing what the words mean, so that you should know for everything. And it's outrageous that, you know, after $1 million of your parents' money spent invested in your Jewish education. TMI.
Yeah, well, you looked at me. I was like, I'm just going.
Kara, this is all being recorded for posterity.
You looked at me and like a very long
No, your stare. Chair squeaked, so I turned. Okay, I thought you were saying something.
Sorry.
I thought you were getting up to engage me in debate. It's astounding, it's shocking that after all of these years and all of these hundreds of thousands of dollars of your parents' money invested in your Jewish education, and the fact that you actually do pray every day, you might not know the meaning of all the words of the Amidah. That's something that's easily rectifiable. Again, open a sitter. Kierkegaard. You've heard of Kierkegaard? A Danish philosopher, 19th century philosopher. Professor David Schatz always observes that he has trouble teaching Kierkegaard in Jewish audiences. You know, he's invited to go, you know, speak at an adult education thing, or he's a scholar in residence, and he's speaking before a crowd, and he says, you know, Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, and he knows once he says the word Danish, everyone's eyes glazes over, and all they can think about is cherry Danish or cinnamon Danish. Kierkegaard is considered the high priest, the grand poobah, the avi avot, the founding father of existentialism. Now, what is existentialism? Another asterisk term that you might add to your list of things to read, to research. What is existentialism? What problem is existentialism driven by?
The human condition.
The human condition. Or human
existence.
Right. Existentialism sought to explore the meaning and purpose and value of human existence. And therefore, the kind of emotion of the existentialist is... Remember Match Game? Fill in the blank. Existential angst. A-N-G-S-T. Angst is just a fancy way of saying
anxiety.
Anxiety. Right.
What's Match Game?
Match Game? Well, as you know from having been a child in the 1970s, it was a very popular game show where they would, Mad Libs? Having been a child on long car rides with your parents in a station wagon in the 1970s, you would have known what Mad Libs was. Mad Libs is a game where there's like a story, but they leave words blank, and you have to fill in a noun or a preposition or a pronoun or a verb or things like that, and you end up... Like I said, you give me a noun. And give me a verb. And then I put all your things into this thing, and you end up getting kind of convoluted. Anyway, lo chashu. Existential angst. The kind of anxiety of existence, that kind of anxiety that you have in the dark night of the soul, trying to figure out who am I and why am I here and what is my purpose in life. That's the starting point of existential thought. Kierkegaard is the founder of this, is considered the founder of this work. It won't be surprising that Kierkegaard has a very important text examining
either or.
But an important text examining Akedat Yitzchak.
Oh, yeah,
can you think of a more existentially fraught experience than a father, you know, who's been promised that his children will found a great nation, to live all those years with it all hanging in the balance because he hasn't had children? He had one son, he thought that might be it. That son is sent away. Yishmael is not the hope. And finally, late in age, he gets Yitzchak. And what does he have to do? Sacrifice the whole thing.
Kierkegaard believed in God.
Kierkegaard is a profoundly religious thinker. Certainly believe in God. Kierkegaard is an important influence. Existentialism is an important influence on Rabbi Soloveitchik. That's why spending some time with him would be useful. Kierkegaard says, hold on, Hegel. Not too quick. Maybe thesis and antithesis are not resolved through synthesis. Maybe there's no easy way to solve this problem. Maybe the two ideas exist in a kind of perpetual tension. You can understand why these existentialists, you know, had that angst. They were probably very deep people, but not necessarily so fun at parties. That idea that there are opposing forces and the two cannot be resolved. There's no happy middle. But that's okay. That's another way to put it. The Rav in his dialectical thought sometimes goes like this and sometimes goes like that. He was not consistent. So, for example, in Halachic Man, he presents us two characters. The cognitive man, the Ish Hada'at in Hebrew, and Homo Religiosus, as he's known in the English translation. That's just a fancy Latin way of saying the man of religion. Please note that in Latin there's no hard G. It's not religiosus, it's religiosus. So, you know, that when you hear people say this, you know, for the rest of your life, you can correct them and feel superior. The Ish Hadat. In other words, in Hebrew, it's quite a play on words. The Ish Hada'at, knowledge, science, and the Ish Hadat, religion. And these two are in opposition. But there is a middle way forward. There is a character who both synthesizes the two of them and stands above and is greater than the sum of the parts, and that's the Ish HaHalacha, the Halachic Man. In Halachic Man, the Rav puts forth a kind of Hegelian view. In the Lowly Man of Faith, there is no Katuv HaShlishi HaMachriya Bineihem. There is no third character that's introduced as being shown to bestride the tension. There's Adam 1 and there's Adam 2, and both of these characters live within us, and if you think you can get them, you can get that tension to resolve, you're mistaken. But you have to live with that tension. In Lowly Man of Faith, he's a Kierkegaardian. He's an existentialist. Now, Halachic Man, you have these sheets? So on the second page of Halachic Man, which is page 4, there's a footnote. Everybody calls it a footnote. I don't know why. You'll hear people talk about footnote 4, but it's not a footnote at all. It's an endnote. A footnote is at the bottom of the page, and an endnote is at the back of the book. But it's endnote 4. Endnote 4 you see here. Notice here on this page you have the text, and here you have the footnote. Circled footnote 4, you see footnote 4 goes on for a really long time. The fourth endnote is an essay unto itself. And the fourth endnote here is in many ways the best introduction to the Rav's thought on these matters. And in that regard, it's very essential to those of us that have been looking at Lonely Man of Faith. Even though Lonely Man of Faith comes to a different kind of resolution, because it helps us understand, why the Rav is so essential to the modern Orthodox worldview. It helps us understand, but the truth is, it helps us understand why Agnon is so essential to the modern Orthodox worldview. Why Agnon can be the most modern of all Hebrew writers, the most modern of all Orthodox writers, and the most Orthodox of all modern Jewish writers. in the Halachic Man, the Rav introduces two characters: the scientist and the person of religion. Now, if that was it, which of them would you think he is his champion? The religious man. But no. It's important to note that in all of these presentations, there's no value judgment going on. It's not a competition. It's not a question of like who's better or who should you be like. He's describing different human attitudes. The cognitive man, the scientist, he's sometimes described in terms that make him look something like a mathematician or an applied physicist. Cognitive man is drunk on knowledge. He seeks to understand the world. He is oblivious of the meta, the metaphysical, and is enchanted and intoxicated and occupied with the physical. What's metaphysical? What are metaphysics?
It's like the study of reality.
No, the opposite. Oh, physics are the study. Physics are what we call science. Physics is the study of this world, the created world, the physical world. Meta is beyond. Why did Facebook rebrand itself as Meta?
Oh, what?
The metaverse. Facebook rebranded itself.
It wants to create like a meta.
No,
meta
is beyond. No. Metaphysical is the realm beyond the physical. Philosophy, theology, spirituality. Cognitive man seems unaware of all of these things. He is a man of this physical world, and he attempts to master the world through his intellectual conquest of it. Religious man, and the religious man here is not a religious Jew. He's saying something about the universal religious condition. Religious man is looking to the heavens. Religious man sees this world, the physical world, the lowly, in the words of the Kabbalah, the Olam HaShafel, we saw yesterday in Vayakov Lemishor, the Olam HaShafel, the lowly world, the physical world, the contaminated world, the world of temptation, the veil of tears. If only we could escape our condition here and attain the heavens, we would have true holiness. We would have true spirituality. We would have communion with God. Halachic man is neither. Halachic man is the hero. Because what does the halacha do? By the way, halacha, in the Rav's use of halacha, there's two types of halacha. There's halacha with a capital H and there's halacha with a lowercase h. Right? If I say, oh, it's Rosh Chodesh, I forgot to say Yalla Viyavo, what's the halacha? That's lowercase halacha. Right? I wonder, what's the din? What's the thing I have to do? But halacha with a capital H, those are my terms, lowercase and capital H. Halacha with a capital H is what other people would refer to as the Torah or Judaism, right? Or the truth. You know, like you may have heard, like some teacher saying, "The Torah says." But you know, you have a Tanakh, and you know how to open it, and you can't find any pasuk in the Torah that says what that teacher says the Torah said. Because when the teacher or the rabbi says, the Torah says, what do they mean?
Halacha.
No, they mean, well, yeah, halacha. They mean, I'm going to distill for you the authentic Jewish worldview on this topic. Right? And they put it into the voice of the anthropomorphized Torah. Right? Or somebody says, Judaism believes. Danger, warning. There aren't too many unequivocal things that can follow that opening sentence. And there's some. Yes, but even there, murder's not always bad. As a matter of fact, there's a mitzvah in the Torah, difficult as it is, that sometimes we have to murder those Amalekites.
Or like anything like
what?
Or
Yirnidacha.
Or Yidacha.
Or whenever there's a Chiyuv Mita.
That's Hamad.
Said it. So you're already splitting the hair. You're already finding the Ketuv HaShlishiya Machriya Beneihem. Right? You're a Hegelian. Right? You say, oh, A and B, they can't go together. One says you can never murder. The other one says sometimes you can murder. How? Because it depends on how you define murder. So, carry a second, keep putting it.
But why do we say that Hegel invented this? If it's what Gemara did, it's what, like...
Hegel didn't invent it. I didn't mean to say that. Go back and erase and correct the tape. I meant that this idea, this kind of mode of philosophical approach, is identified with Hegel and his school. Very rarely, when you say that this idea is from Aristotle, that idea is from Hegel, this idea is from Kierkegaard, it doesn't mean that they were the first ones. They're the ones that put their name on it. They're the ones that kind of advanced our way of thinking about it, so much so that they lay claim to it. Mm-hmm. Right? He wrote on it, he explained it, he delved into it, he became identified with him as a school of thought. So now look at this passage at the beginning of page 4. It starts in the middle.
Wait, did we define what halacha?
So halacha, I'm sorry. Halacha is, when the Rav uses the term halacha, it's kind of like this phrase that means the entire distillation of the authentic Jewish worldview. What others might call Judaism, what others might call Torah, for the Rav he calls it halacha, because for the Rav, the halacha, principally as embodied in the Gemara, but not only, the halacha represents the authentic Jewish worldview. And after all, there's nothing more dialectic than a page of Gemara. So look here at the text at, we only have a couple minutes. Look here at the text at the beginning. It says, the soul of cognitive man, this soul contradicts all of the desires and strivings of the religious soul. In many ways, the beginning of Halachic Man, which is a very short book, right? The Halachic Man itself, the essay itself, if you cut out the notes, is a total of about 130 pages, 136 pages, right? It's not long at all. And in many ways, the presentation positions Halachic Man as being closer to the cognitive man than he is to the homo religiosus. Because after all, what is the realm of Halacha? Heaven or earth? Earth. This world, the physical world, is the world in which the Halacha comes and sanctifies. This relates to my comments the other day about how the Jewish sexual ethic differs from the Christian view. We'll get into that later in the semester. The purpose of the Halacha is to take our existence as beasts with desires and appetites and drives, and to create a framework in which that can all be sanctified. And therefore, a halachic man fears death, because with death, the halachic project, the halachic enterprise, comes to an end. So this soul contradicts all of the desires of the other. However, Rivka, read from however.
However, these opposing forces which struggle together.
Louder, louder.
However, these opposing forces which struggle together in the religious consciousness of halachic man are not of a destructive or disjunctive nature. Halachic man is not some illegitimate, unstable hybrid.
Oh, so halachic man is this kind of synthesis of these two other characters, these two other opposing forces. So you would think, like, you have these two opposing forces that are somehow contained in one person. It's going to split him apart. He's going to have a split personality. He's going to be illegitimate. He's going to be an unstable hybrid.
Which two forces?
Cognitive man and religious man. Right? The scientist and the saint. No, it doesn't make him unstable. Why? Because here the Rav is which kind of dialectician?
Synthesizing.
A Hegelian, right? We can find the synthesis between the two. On the contrary,
out of the contradictions and antinomies, there emerges a radiant, holy personality whose soul has been purified in the furnace of struggle and opposition and redeemed in the fires of the torments of spiritual disharmony to a degree unmatched by the universal homo religiosus. The deep split of the soul prior to its being united
may at times raise a man to a rank of perfection, which for sheer brilliance and beauty is unequaled by any level attained by the simple, whole personality who has never been tried by the pangs of spiritual discord. In accordance with the suffering is the reward. In accordance
it's a mission in Avot. What's that mission? What's the makor for that? What's the phrase in Avot? It's not Hebrew, it's Aramaic.
And in accordance with the split, the union, this spiritual fusion that characterizes halachic man is distinguished by its consummate splendor, for did not the split touch the very depths, the innermost core of his being? There is much truth to the fundamental contention set forth by both the dialectical philosophies of
Heraclitus is the 5th, 6th BCE Greek philosopher who said, most famously, he's most well known for having said, you can't step into the river twice, same river twice, because flux, everything comes about through flux. But he also says that through tension, tension is the source of creativity.
And Hegel, with regard to the ongoing course of existence.
With regard to the ongoing course of existence.
In general, and views of Kierkegaard, Karl Barth, and Rudolf Otto with regard to the religious consciousness and its embodiment in the experience of homo religiosus, in particular, namely, that there is a creative power embedded within antithesis.
And the creative power of antithesis, of these two forces struggling within us, well, I mean, it can be overwhelming. It can be destructive. Some people read this essay and say, I don't know what he's talking about. If I had to live with that, it would kill me. But it says, no. It can be creative. It can be a source of energy. As a matter of fact, the essay is divided into two parts. The second part, the shorter, and actually, I think more, the first 100 pages of the essay is this description of these characters and how they relate to each other. The second part, which is only 30-some-odd pages, is called His Creative Capacity. That's the hallmark of the halachic man, is the creativity that's harnessed through this inner tension. When he's talking about creativity, he's talking about quite an intellectual halachic creativity. But it has many implications for every other form of human creativity, including artistic creativity. There's an excellent essay by Walter Wurzberger, which you can find on the Tradition website, called The Centrality of Creativity in the Thought of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, if that's a topic that interests you. I'm not sure we're going to come back to it later in the semester. We're out of time, and we didn't even get to the fourth footnote. But those of you that are interested in doing some reading before our course begins at the beginning of the semester on the Holy Man of Faith, I recommend reading this fourth footnote. The kind of thing that it's good to read maybe together with someone else. You know, there are two ways to read something. You can read it, or you can read it. This is a text that needs to be unpacked. Now, you'll encounter all types of things. I didn't even get to mention Rudolf Otto and Karl Barth, two important figures to this conversation. But again, they also live online. But I think sitting together with someone and going through the note, this little self-contained essay, is a very good introduction. And kind of filling in, using all the terms and concepts and philosophical jargon and philosophical figures that he mentions as a kind of roadmap to build your own syllabus of things you should look up as you go along is recommended. If anybody would be interested, I'd be happy to come and find time to sit and go through it together, you know, outside of regular class time. I'll make reference to it later in the semester, and those of you listening along at home are welcome to download the text and look there as well. So until we pick up Rabbi Soloveitchik again later in the semester, I do recommend getting The Lonely Man of Faith. You can get it in I don't know what they're going to do. They're going to have like one central purchase of it.
I'm not sure.
If you go into the used bookstores, you can often find a copy in the used bookstore, or you can download it from the web. Although I'm a fan of having books that you can annotate and put notes in the margins and all that other good stuff.
What's our opening story for next class?
The two. Excess, it's, there were two short stories. It was on the page. Mm-hmm. To Father's House and
To the Doctor.
And To the Doctor. Mm-hmm. If you want the Hebrew, I can send that as well.